Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Barbara Hamm-Lee. We are 4 days away from an historic election. If Democrat Hillary Clinton wins, she will be the first female president of the United States. If Donald Trump wins, he will be the first president to serve without previous political experience. News report says the numbers are down for early voting among African Americans. So does this mean we're not going to the polls on Tuesday? Political pundit Eric LaVille is here with food for thought before you cast your vote. The LaVille Report on Another View is next, right after this news from NPR.
Discussing today's topics from an African-American perspective, this is Another View.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Another View. I'm Barbara Hamm-Lee. Despite the poll numbers, predictions from political pundits, or pleas from the candidates themselves, the truth is no one knows who's going to win next Tuesday's presidential election. It's in our hands, the voters, and we have to vote. It is our responsibility to our country, to our communities, and yes, to our race. There's been a lot of noise around who would be best fit to serve as president, but today we want to be thoughtful about what should matter most as we cast our vote on Tuesday. We're happy to welcome back to Another View Dr. Eric LaVille, Assistant Professor of History, Political Science, and Law at Hampton University, political pundit for WTKR News 3 and The Washington Post, and creator of the award-winning LaVille Report, heard here on Another View. How you doing, Eric?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much, Barbara.
No problem. It's great for you to be here, and I'm really looking forward to our conversation. So, yes. Okay, the conspiracy theorist in me says that all this talk, all these articles, all this focus this week on the numbers being down in early voting for African Americans is just simply a way to discourage the African American community from voting. Do you agree or disagree with that?
It really all depends on, you know, how it's framed and how you communicate the story, okay? Any news can be good news. Any news can be bad news. However, the numbers are true. There is a, across the country, especially in battleground states, there is a down number of African Americans going out to early vote. In part, that's because that they're not excited about this election. Also, because we're starting to see the effect of voter suppression laws and what they're doing in these various states, especially in the state of North Carolina. More specifically, in one county in North Carolina, there's only one place to go early vote.
Yes, in Guilford County.
Yeah, Guilford County. Mm-hmm. Where the
in
state.
In Greensboro, right? You have to go to Greensboro in order to vote.
Yeah, I mean, that's the only place. Now, that's not by accident, that's by design.
And so, there were 16 places in the last election.
That is correct. Yeah. Also, in the state of Ohio, you also have a lot of voter suppression where the Secretary of State, the governor's office, where there were laws that were created where if you don't sign properly, meaning if your squiggly line for your signature is slide off, then you can't, it's not valid. If you sign on the wrong line, it's not valid and so forth. All of these have been reported throughout other news sites and so forth. So it's not, you know, these aren't things that we're just throwing up as myths, but they're actually reality.
But the other thing that we also hear in the news reports, too, is that, well, black people aren't going to vote because President Obama is not running anymore. I mean, is it fair to say that African-Americans only vote for African-Americans? I mean, that's ridiculous, isn't it?
It is. And of course, the data simply doesn't show that. Now, it does show that because President Obama was on the ballot those 2 years, you did see an uptick of African-American voter participation. And that's good. Finally, you have individuals that feel that someone that looks like them, someone that has similar experiences as them, can reach the highest office of the land or can participate in government, which gives them hope to believe. It happens for every group. Whether you're female, whether you're a person from another nationality or ethnicity, it happens.
Well, but you bring that up, and that's a very interesting point, because I don't hear, of all the things that you hear surrounding the candidacy of Hillary Clinton, the woman card is very low key, if at all, in terms of what I think someone would expect to hear of the first female to become president of the United States.
And honestly, I think that they made a mistake. I think the Hillary campaign made a mistake not to play that up. And of course, I'm a proponent of not using the word card because I think it's a misnomer and it's also an innuendo which causes fallacies and misleading. And it's a part of, you know, rhetorical devices that causes individuals to think negative about certain aspects of that. So the race card is not a game. Race is a reality in everyday life. So it takes away the significance of it. But back to Hillary Clinton possibly being the first female president of the United States, I think that was something big. I think that's something that the Hillary campaign did not capitalize upon. I think that for her, I mean, whatever you believe about her, I mean, she comes from a family that had to work extremely hard to get to where they were. She went to the worked her way up to what were considered the best schools at that particular time, a Yale Law School graduate. Ironically, in that law school class, I mean, you had, of course, her husband, Bill Clinton. You also had Clarence Thomas in that class. And you also had others that when you find out what they do, that was really a class, that law school class that at Yale that really kind of changed what we're doing today and really made a large impact. So, I mean, for someone to be that accomplished, of course, her positions that she had throughout government and so forth, I mean, I think that she represents someone that could be in a good representation of the first woman president.
But all the other controversies, the emails, et cetera, keep surrounding her. You think that it's keeping that good thing, if you will, being suppressed? Or
No, I think they're separate issues. So I think it's apples and oranges. I think, again, the Hillary Clinton campaign did not play that up more. They did not, you know, tout that. And that's a very good thing. I mean, because in our country, we have a country that was started where only white males of privilege were able to participate in this experiment called the United States of America. It wasn't until the women's suffrage where women got the opportunity to vote. And not only that, but it wasn't until the civil rights movement with the passage of Title IX in the 1964 Civil Rights Act, where white women, more specifically, got the opportunity to participate in all things as men. And also they benefited more from affirmative action than anyone else. So it's a great thing, you know, to have Hillary Clinton as a woman where she is, which it was also a good thing to have, say, Sarah Palin, again, you know, whatever you think about her. But it was a good thing to see her on that ticket when John McCain ran against President Obama unsuccessfully, of course. Mm-hmm. But the other side of it is that I think they also fail to, you know, put those negatives into a positive light. In other words, as Americans, we are very, very apt to give individuals a second chance. If you admit what you did wrong, you don't try to cover it up, and you simply, you know, ask with humility and be contrite about it. Now, we've seen it happen many, many times, but I think they tried to keep covering up, saying, oh, it doesn't matter, it doesn't matter. Now, on the opposite side, you had the Trump campaign that started to pounce on that and that started to create that part of those mistakes as part of fear-mongering to build up a negative campaign. I also think that Hillary campaign they campaigned for the wrong election. I think they made a lot of mistakes in underestimating the rhetorical force and extreme rhetoric of demagoguery of Donald Trump because of who the GOP base is.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that the Democratic Party has taken the African-American vote for granted? That they maybe felt that, okay, that's a shoo-in, so it's not necessary for us to be in that community as heavily as we've been in the past. It feels like this week there's this desperation as opposed to a strategic bringing in of the community.
Unequivocally, I agree with that, and I've also said it many, many times. The African-American vote has been taken for granted on the Democratic side. If you look at, and listen, I mean, it's been said before, but in everything that's said, there's some inkling of truth. So you kind of have to pull it out and really analyze it and critically think about it. But if you look at the communities where you have a mostly inner cities, African-American voters, the policies that were created, and a lot of those policies that were created came from under Nixon, also Reagan and President Bill Clinton, which have crippled the African-American community and caused what we have in a lot of inner cities today, which is poor housing, poor education, a lot of crime, drugs, and the like. So I think a lot of those policies have been detrimental, not all because of Democrats. Don't get me wrong, not all because I first stated it came under Nixon, which is part of what we call the Southern Strategy. The creator of that was Liat Water in politics. And then, of course, you had other operatives through public policy within the Nixon administration. I mean, it's very famous. There's an article that's written where Mitt Romney's father, who was president of HUD at the time under Nixon, actually warned the Nixon administration about the policies that were created and the effects it would have on cities like Baltimore. And he was effectively run out of the Nixon administration because that's what they wanted to happen. So with that being the case, I think that it's also the fault of a lot of our African-American officials to push the Democratic Party, which, again, African-Americans are one of the most faithful Democratic voters of when you look at blocks of votes, but push them for policies of economics and education.
So millennials and younger voters did not experience the Bill Clinton era as baby boomers did and so forth. So do you think there's a division between generations in terms of the African-American vote?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The attitude also of how could you support a Trump seems to be another carrier in terms of why no one thought it was important to really court the black vote, if you will.
Exactly. So again, that was a calculation era, I think, about Hillary campaign. They figured, since Trump is running, and of course there's not a lot of support for Trump in the African-American community, whether it be millennials or older. I mean, it's just not there. I mean, because he had to represent the base of the Southern Strategy, those individuals that were coming to the GOP under the Southern Strategy, now that are part of the Tea Party, more extreme policies of that particular party, which is in part why John Boehner resigned and nobody wanted the Speaker of the House because of that. But we'll talk about that in just a moment. However, when you look at the miscalculation by the Hillary campaign, they figure, we're going to be the best choice for them. They're not going to vote for Trump, so we don't have to really pay attention to their issues. It wasn't until Bernie Sanders made inroads with the millennials and also the first candidate to address and sit down with Black Lives Matter, the first candidate to really sit down and with Al Sharpton. He sat down with them and talked about those issues where they saw that this is the only person they cared about. Now, again, I teach this demographics from 18 to 25. Every day I've taught this demographic for the last half decade. And these individuals, I've seen the shift. There's not a lot of excitement for Hillary Clinton. There was tremendous excitement for Bernie Sanders, tremendous. Now, don't get me wrong. You do have some Bernie Sanders supporters that are millennials, more specifically college students, that are going to vote for Hillary Clinton because of they don't want to vote for Trump and they don't want a Trump presidency. However, you also have another large part of those individuals that are not going to vote for either candidate or they're going to vote for a third party candidate.
Which is going to be problematic. And I know we're going to come to your prediction in just a little bit in terms of who you think may win the election. 440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240 are the numbers to call. We're talking about voting and we're talking about why it is critical, particularly for the African-American community, to turn out on November the 8th. 440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. Did you do early voting? Have you done absentee voting? Do you plan to be standing in line on November the 8th? 440-2665. Give us a call and let's talk. Eric, this week, church bombed. Yes. African-American church was bombed in the South. Had Vote Trump on the building. Yeah. There's been talk. You know, Trump is... had his coded language of go to those places, those neighborhoods in Philadelphia to watch voting going on. People talking about in open carry states that they're going to be those there standing there with their guns on their hips, you know, watching as people go in to vote. This whole voter intimidation thing, how much is that going to play in terms of what's going to happen on Tuesday?
I think it's going to play a huge part in voter turnout, also voter suppression. Make no mistake about it. I believe that the Trump campaign, and I don't know if he realized what he has created. But he, in my opinion, Donald Trump is the creation. He was created by the GOP. All right. When I say created by the GOP, what I mean by that, he was created by a party that ignored their base, that continued to support big business. Okay, these large tax breaks and so forth, which Donald Trump is one of those that took advantage of it. Okay, and he was very vocal and honest about it. Again, honesty. Yes, I didn't pay tax, but you know it was legal. So, in addition to that, it was also a party that ignored the Main Street workers, you know, or what they call Joe the Plumber. You know, the hardworking individual that's either a private business or a small business or works for someone, you know, but, you know, has their property, has their family, and just wants to live a good life. They ignore them. Now, by doing that, all right, what Donald Trump, I believe, has done is that he has incorporated the actions of his mentor, Roy Cohn, which is the ruthless attorney who was the chief counsel for Senator McCarthy and went after. He was also part of the attorneys that went after the Rosenbergs that put them to death for spying. And he was the mentor of Donald Trump. He was the one that taught him how to use various types of language, how to use the legal system as a weapon when individuals come after you. Deny, deny, deny. And a lot of people refer to Roy Cohn, I mean, as the devil. I mean, because he was just that ruthless. In addition to that, he also incorporated what we call code language from the Southern Strategy created by Lee Atwater. Again, this 1968 and beyond, starting with Richard Nixon and then further on, really it started with Barry Goldwater, and then you move on to Richard Nixon and so forth. So by doing this, it's a lot of code language. Make America Great Again is code language for America is not great because of the policies of the Democratic Party, because of it's not run 100% by white Americans, because of individuals have come into our country and taken our jobs, because of our jobs are now shipped overseas, which was created by, in part, and a lot of these policies passed by the Republican Party and big business took advantage of them. But he created that. So therefore, he has now been able to take the proverbial foot off of the head of the serpent of this very, very bad time in our country's history, where those individuals that believe these things. I mean, it's given rise to David Duke again. I mean, David Duke was just at Dillard University.
Yeah, he was just at Dillard University, and there was almost a riot there.
Yeah, you know, and, you know, talking again, spewing that very, very divisive rhetoric. And Donald Trump himself, like I said, I don't think he understood he was using the Southern Strategy, but I know that he was utilizing, because he was mentored by Roy Cohn, the ability to use extreme rhetoric and demagoguery by spewing and creating fallacies such as poisoning the well, it's what I teach my students in critical thinking. When a person uses argumentum ad hominem, which is arguments to the person, not answering the question. So therefore you then discredit the person's character. You then misrepresent the statement. You then slant the argument in your direction. Okay. As opposed to
anything, just answering the question.
Exactly. So you're exactly right.
Our phones are lit up. Let's go to the phones. Dr. Warren Stewart joins us from Norfolk. How are you, sir?
Ms. Ham,
yes.
Honored to always be part of listening and participating in your conversation.
Thank you very much.
I'm concerned about the number of, and I'd like to hear the opinions of your speakers today, of the efficacy and the ethical nature of someone who cannot vote for either of the primary candidates. I'm curious about beginning the day after the election, what's the effect and what's the ethical nature of that? And I'd love their opinions.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for the call. Go ahead, Eric.
Sure. By not voting for either candidate, now it is your right to vote and it's your right not to vote as well. Okay. And a lot of these individuals that have chosen not to vote in the election because they don't agree with either candidate or their candidate of choice has been railroaded, they feel, by the system. These individuals are what you call principled voters. I mean, they're, you know, just like in the military, you have conscientious objectors. You know, these are individuals that have sat down, really thought about this and said, I'm not going to participate based upon their principles. Is it ethical? I mean, that's that's an issue that every individual person has to make. However, it is, how do we get those individuals to vote? You have, the candidates have to engage them. Okay. So if you want their vote, and they're usually a Democratic or GOP voter, you have to go after them. You have to sit down and speak to their issues and make them believe that they have a stake in your candidacy and your official time in office.
So, but the election is Tuesday. Yes. I mean, at this point, it's too late.
It is.
For that. So all we can do at this point is just really encourage people to, what, swallow and hard and push a button anyway? Or how the dynamic of not going, what is that going to do to the overall vote?
Well, I think what's going to end up happening is that by not going, I think it's going to favor GOP candidates in their areas. And I say candidates because we have more than just a president, yes, on the ballot. Sure. Okay, we have down ballot issues, we have down ballot candidates, and so forth. And all politics is local. So if you have participation and you have a stake in your local politics, and you see your candidate and or your representative all the time, your local city council person, your U.S. congressman all the time, they come to your church, things like that, you're going to go vote for them, so you're going to go to the polls. When you get inside the polls, it's very hard for you to look at that presidential ballot and say, you know what, I have to vote. I just cannot vote for anyone. Now, so you're going to vote. I believe that that particular strategy, that particular person is going to favor the GOP because their voters are historically more principled on voting. I'm going to go vote because it is my duty to vote, not just because of that, but also because they have more of a stake in my opinion, in their local politics, because their local politics affects more of what they do. Okay.
Well, which then would mean, or should mean, that the African-American community should turn out in droves. I mean, if you're looking at down ballot, because that is where the community is affected.
Well, again, it goes back to understanding how public policy affects you. Now, overall, these issues I've talked about the Nixon administration and also the Reagan administration and Clinton administration, those public policies, those are very scholarly type, yes, issues that is very hard to break down to only a few, you know, only a handful of people can break that down, right, to the average person and say, this is why you need to come out and vote. These are also policies that are not just going to affect you immediately, but affect you 10, 25, 40 years down the road, what we call generational impact of policies, as opposed to those policies that affect you immediately. If you're a homeowner, okay, a raise in the millage tax, you know, for the, yeah, city, is going to affect your tax base and the taxes you pay on your personal property, whether it be in the Commonwealth or wherever. You know, those individuals, those U.S. Representatives that come to the company picnic where you work, you see that person all the time. You have a personal connection with them. So an individual that, and when I say they don't have a stake in the community, it's not saying they don't want to. It's not saying they don't live there. It's saying that the policies of that locality do not support them positively, nor do they see how it affects them negatively.
Hmm. Let's go to Jan in Newport News. Hi, Jan. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I have two brief questions. One of them is, what do I need to bring to the polls? I know that we, in Virginia, we have voter ID. We have to bring that. And then my other quick question is, what happens if neither candidate gets to 270? I know that there's a third-party candidate and independent candidates, and I know that they're soaring, especially in like Utah, like Evan McCullen. And, you know, what happens if no one gets to 270? So that was okay, basically my question.
Thank you, Jan, for that call. We'll get those answers for you. What happens if we don't get to 270? Let's start with that.
First of all, you have to get to 270 somehow. Now, that's never happened. And a candidate will get to 270. At this particular point, there is not a third-party candidate out there that can win any state. It's just not going to happen. Gary Johnson or Jill Stein, the numbers don't support it, period. So it is majority rule. Is one vote, is 50, is one vote over, so the majority. So in the event, let's just say, Hillary Clinton in the state of Virginia gets 48% of the vote. Donald Trump gets 40, let's just say he gets 45% of the vote, and then other percentages are about third-party candidates. Mm-hmm. Even though she didn't get 50% of the vote, she still gets all of the electoral votes.
All the electoral. So, right. So I got you. And also, what do we need to bring to the polls?
Right. So, first of all, in order to vote, and if you should know if you are registered to vote, the voter electorate should have sent you a card, or you can look it up on the voter registration for the state of Virginia. But you also need a valid ID, a Virginia driver's license, a photo ID. You can use a veteran's ID from the Virginia DMV, your military ID. You can also use a U.S. passport card. You can also use a student ID issued by any institution of higher education or private school in the state of Virginia. You can use an employee ID issued by your employer. You can use nursing home resident ID issued by a government facility, tribal enrollment, or tribal ID card. There are 11 recognized tribes in the state, but all of this is online. You can go to their Virginia voter registration, and it outlines exactly what you need to do.
Okay, if you're just joining us, we're talking about things to consider as you cast your vote on this coming Tuesday, November the 8th, with assistant professor and political pundit Dr. Eric Clavel, creator of the Clavel Report. Let's see. Albert joins us from Virginia Beach. Hi, Albert. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I find both candidates that made it to the primary, Mrs. Clinton and Mr. Trump, highly objectionable as candidates for president. And a lot of my peers do, too. I'm African-American. I'm 40. I'm middle class. And I generally would vote. However, I find it difficult to show up to the polls next week, as is the expectation, even here in this forum, to vote for either candidate. I wish Rand Paul had made it, and he did not. So I guess the challenge is really to yourselves. Why am I, as an African-American, expected to show up to the polls and vote for either candidate when neither of them really are aligned with my real values?
Okay.
Which has little to do with being African-American as much as it has to do with being one who worked hard to get into the middle class and stay in the middle class.
Okay, Albert.
And as on the last note, a lot of objections to a growing federal government, which I have my concerns. Both candidates would do, like every president before them, going into their own presidency.
All right. Let me let Eric answer your questions. Thanks so much for the call.
Sure. Thank you so much for your call. I mean, we're actually in the same age bracket. I mean, mm-hmm. But again, as I stated earlier to a caller, it's your right to vote or not to vote. Okay. And your right to vote or not to vote is your personal decision. But you also have to realize, as I tell my students and I remind myself, for every action, there's a reaction. So when you think about these candidates, you ask yourself, if I don't agree with the candidates, let's look at the policies that are going to come from these various parties and what are those issues that matter to me. I believe as we go into Sunday, the souls to the poll push in both majority African-American churches, majority white churches, and other churches. And I mention those two because those are the two largest demographic churches that individuals go to, especially what you call Protestant or Christian churches. There's going to be a major push to justify going to vote based upon issues and forget about the shortcomings, especially the moral shortcomings of the candidates. So individuals are going to look at those issues. So one of the major issues that are out there is the U.S. Supreme Court. The next president is going to appoint at least two Supreme Court justices. You have one that's going
to. You've got Republicans saying that if Hillary Clinton gets into office, that they will not appoint. And they will not approve a candidate for
sure,
the Supreme Court.
Sure. And again, I believe that, and we'll talk about this later, but I believe that what Trump has done, I mean, this is what we see now is the end of the GOP party as we know it. Anyone that's going to be elected under the Republican tag, they're going to have to, in the midterm elections, they're going to have to become more extreme, more like the Tea Party, period. If not, they're going to lose to someone who is more extreme. John Boehner knew that. That's why he could not work with that particular Congress anymore. And America itself simply cannot take a lot more of the blaming because of the things that we have coming down the pipe. I have a piece that I'm working on called The First 100 Days and what the next president will have to step into. Whoever becomes president, I believe they're going to be a one-term president because the weight of the issues that we have to deal with in this particular country and increasingly with international policy in the world.
All right. I know that the phone's lit up, but I know also that you have a prediction for hang on. Before you say what it is, I want to remind listeners that back in 2015,
yes,
we had you on the show, and this is what was said.
And Trump has a great show going on. And let me tell you, he's going to get the nomination. He's going to get it.
Oh, you heard it here first. You heard it here first.
So that was the roundtable. You were a part of the roundtable. You predicted that Donald Trump was going to get the nomination. We all were, oh my goodness, really? All right, so 4 days away. Who do you think is going to be president, Eric?
4 days away. I believe that both campaigns have made a lot of mistakes. However, the campaign head of Trump's campaign made a statement that I agree with, and I agree with her in the moment she said it. When Donald Trump had that 2 weeks of very bad press, you know, with the Khan family and then also his comments about women and so forth, I mean, he was on the ropes. I mean, he was on the ropes. The GOP was running away from him, and he was just waiting for a knockout punch. And the Hillary campaign, the Democratic Party, could have put him away. She made a statement and said that they're going to regret not putting him away. I believe because of the effect of voter suppression, those laws that we're going to see start take effect, I believe because the Democratic Party did not pay attention to their base, which are college voters, millennials, I believe, and also African-American voters, those in that demographics, I believe because they were not able to overcome the negatives of their campaign, I believe that if the numbers stay as they are, if the numbers stay as they are, which is a statistical dead heat, I believe that Donald Trump will win Ohio, he'll win Florida, he'll win Nevada, and the leaning Republican states that will put him over the 270.
So you believe that if everything stays the way it is today in terms of the statistical heat, that Donald Trump will win?
I do.
Wow.
And again, I believe that this Democratic candidate, and really any Democratic candidate, you have to be at least 3 percentage points safety out of the margin of error, okay? The margin of error, which is usually 2 to 3%, all right, for those really good polls, in order to solidify your victory. Right now, the race is a statistical dead heat, and it's within that 2 to 3% margin of error. Again, I believe that the push of souls to the polls in these churches in order to justify voting for Trump, because a lot of Republicans, and especially church-going Republicans, don't want to vote for Trump. They do not. However, the campaign itself, the message has been centered around issues.
Do you believe that in these polls also that there are a lot of people who have been asked who they're going to vote for, and they say that they're not going to vote for Trump, but they actually will go into the booth to vote for Trump?
They will. And it's based upon what I stated earlier, when you actually get there. Because, you know, your local congressman who you know is running, or your local city councilman is running, and so forth, then what's end up happening, you're going to vote for someone.
Okay. Aaron joins us from Virginia Beach. Hi, Aaron. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, the previous caller enlightened or reminded me of something I've seen going along a lot in this campaign, and it's how personal people take their vote to a judgmental level that they wouldn't even be able to pass. I mean, both of these candidates have their flaws and have made mistakes but just like any other one of us. And I just see like, but they're also like exceptional people, have excelled in their field and have helped and assisted millions and millions of people, Hillary Clinton, in my opinion, more so than Donald Trump, to better their lives. And it just amazes me that I hear people break it down to, you know, on such a personal level. And I never realized how, again, I hate to use the word again, personal the vote that somebody makes for president is.
All right, Aaron, let me let Eric answer, because we got a lot of calls I'm going to try to get in. But Eric, you want to respond to what he's saying about the personal, how personal it's become?
Yeah, you know, he has a very good point. I admire anyone that runs for public office, okay? anyway, because you're putting your life, your personal life, in the forefront. You're giving individuals an opportunity to judge you, whether fairly or unfairly. And you're also, you know, look, I have a family. You're taking away from your family time, okay? And that's a strain on your relationships. And then you're having to make deals and beholdings to individuals that you normally would not make beholdings to. However, again, it all goes down to how you shape your message. And Donald Trump has been able, his campaign, by creating fallacies, red herrings, you know, skating the issues and the question and questioning the character of his candidate by at the same time misplacing the burden of proof on his character and the light, and appealing to emotion and appealing to, and I use this word in its proper context, appealing to ignorance, which simply means without knowledge or evidence or proof. Okay. So therefore he's been able to stop their critical thinking process of the average voter.
The issues really get lost in all the emotion of the both candidates.
Look, in this piece I'm working on called The First 100 Days, you know, we've got, number one, we've got the economy to worry about. We've got $19 trillion in debt, which was started first with the Bush administration after a surplus left by Bill Clinton. You also have the issue of Social Security. Nobody wants to talk about it, but we have to. We have to raise the age limit of it. Okay, and possibly decrease the benefits for those coming in. And finally, we've got the international issue in the Middle East. And I truly believe that we're headed toward a massive headway with a lot of other world powers. And I believe in 2019, we're going to be there toward what we call World War III.
Wow. That's a loaded set. We've got 10 minutes left and you dropped that on me. But expound on that just a little bit, and then I want to go to try to get a couple more calls in.
Sure. Right now, of course, during the time of the Bush administration, Iraq itself became destabilized. We took Saddam, we removed Saddam Hussein out under false pretenses. He did not have what we said that he had. And in addition to that, what we did, we took the proverbial foot off of the head of the serpent. He was a dictator that kept all the other dictators in check. Everybody was afraid of him. When he was removed, those factions started to resurface. In addition to that, you had the destabilization of the Middle East, of Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, all under President Obama, and then going into Syria. Okay, right now Syria is ground zero for this. And don't forget, we also had the uprising in Turkey. Turkey is the old Persian Ottoman Empire, which is the gateway to the Balkan area. Keep in mind, World War I started in the Balkans. That's still a very, very hotbed. That's still a hotbed there in Eastern Europe.
This sounds like another Clavel report I have to do at some point. Thomas joins us from Windsor. Hi, Thomas. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah. Thanks for having me. I think that you did one of the previous callers a big disservice. The lady that called and asked about the Electoral College. Unfortunately, there are a few things that you said that weren't correct, and I would like if maybe you could go into it
sure.
a little more in depth. We actually have had an electoral deadlock before. John Quincy Adams and Andrew Jackson, the whole corrupt bargain thing. And then even today, although, like you said, it is first past the post for electoral votes, we have a odd number of different states that vote. So there are a couple of paths for both candidates to get 269, like if Trump wins New Hampshire and Maine District 2, and then it would go to the House. So I was wondering if you could maybe expand on how that would work, because it's every state delegation gets a vote in Congress. It's not every representative. And so I just think that if you could go into that a little bit more, because I feel like maybe it didn't get the answer it deserved the first time. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Thomas, for your comment. What do you want to say, Eric?
Well, again, thank you so much for that. And callers, I tell you, you know, like I tell my students, you know, make sure you do your research for yourself. And thank you for bringing up that historical deadlock. I believe that if there is a tie or there is a point where individuals would not, the two candidates would not be the likely voter, then what would end up happening is that you would end up having a constitutional battle. Okay. And with that constitutional battle, we'll look at something what very happened a lot during the time of the Bush Gore, where it went to the U.S. Supreme Court to be decided. Now, do I think that it will get there? I don't think so. Do I think that there may be some type of controversy around the voting process? Yes. However, and I don't want to go into all the ways that a tie could be broken, But I will give you this article. It was one that was written by Time Magazine. Time Magazine did a very good piece called Here's What Happens If the Electoral College Ties. It was written by a gentleman named J. Newton Small. If you go to that, it was just written last month, September. So if you go to that, it tells you all the possible ways that a tie could be broken.
Let me ask you a question. Donald Trump said very specifically that he would let us know on November the 9th if he did not win, whether he would accept the will of the people in terms of the outcome of the election.
Sure.
What does that look like?
Now, again, as I stated, if the numbers hold in a statistical dead heat, I think Donald Trump would eventually.
I mean, if he wins, he's going to be fine.
Right. He'll be fine, which means he trusts it, which means that argument is moot. However, if he does not get, if he doesn't win, if the national polls tick up between 1 to 2 percentage points, then I don't think that's a hurdle that Donald Trump can overcome. I do not. And Hillary Clinton would be elected. However, could he stir up controversy and trouble? I think so. Would he say no, I'm not going to stir up controversy and trouble and see to my defeat? I don't think so.
You don't see him making that call.
You know, especially if he believes there's some hocus pocus going on, you know, some funny business in a state that's very, very close. Like, for example, I think the election is going to come down to Florida. I think it's going to come down to Florida. Florida, again, is going to decide this election of the president. If that happens, I think that you're going to see him hold out as long as possible.
Where's Virginia going to fall?
I think Hillary Clinton's going to win Virginia. She's out of that that margin of error here in Virginia. The Democratic Party here has done a very good job getting the surrogates out. Also, I believe having Senator Tim Kaine, who's a very likable politician, likable individual, has the family that a lot of Americans can identify with. I think he did a very good job overall getting. Being on the ticket and getting Virginia. I think the governor also has done a good job in getting surrogates out and so forth. So everyone that's connected to the Clintons, connected to the Democratic Party in the state of Virginia, in those pockets of Northern Virginia, Richmond area, Hampton Roads, where the base of the vote is. However, I think that the Hillary campaign made a mistake by not putting Bernie Sanders as vice president on the ticket. I think that if they would have done that, I think this race would have been over a long time ago. Okay. Long time ago. Again, and that's not saying Tim Kaine is not a great candidate. I like him a lot. But I think for the election, I believe that Bernie Sanders would have been the one to do.
Okay, we've got about 4 minutes left.
Sure.
If you go to the polls on Tuesday and you feel some sort of voter intimidation, or if, you know, as Mr. Trump and others have said, you know, encouraging people to come out and watch how other people vote, et cetera, what should you do?
Well, first of all, I've actually served as a poll protector. So you will have individuals at the polls, which called voter protection, that you can report those to. And they go to a main office, and in that main office, what they do is that they basically investigate it and so forth, and they mark it down, something that may be investigated later if it doesn't resolve itself there. A lot of these issues can be resolved with the individuals that work the polls. We have a wonderful, in every state, every jurisdiction, we have wonderful volunteers that are able to answer your questions, that are friendly, that will be able to answer anything, problems that you have. Of course, you know, you do have your local law enforcement that you can call in the event that you feel that someone 600 feet from the poll or 1,001 feet from the poll or in an open carry state has their open carry on them and they have a certain sign, which happened in here in Virginia. You had two individuals that had their open carry weapon in the parking lot of a Democrat looking in the window in their parking space with a Trump Penn sign staring in the window for X amount of hours. Now, what job allows you to take off to do that? I don't know, but probably didn't have one. So if you see something like that, you can call your local law enforcement to come and they can take care of that. But if you see any voter intimidation or you feel you're being intimidated, you know, do not take actions into your own hands. That's only going to cause more issues. Cooler heads will prevail. Keep in mind, we've had a peaceful transfer of power many, many times in this particular country. However, since this country has been in inception, we also have been in a major war every 10 years as well. So It is what it is.
2 minutes left.
Yes.
Tell the voter who called in earlier who said, why are you trying to tell me to vote? I really don't want to vote. Give some words of encouragement as to still, despite who's running,
sure,
we still need to exercise our right.
Listeners, it is your right to vote or not to vote. However, just don't think about who's on the top of the ballot. Think about everything else. All the ballot measures. Here we have the right to work ballot measure. Other states, you have legalized recreational marijuana and things of that nature, and many, many other local ballot initiatives and elected officials. Think about those. Even if you don't want to vote for a presidential candidate, go and vote those issues, and you can find out what those issues are online in your local jurisdiction and the like. And finally, you think about the right to vote. Think about all those individuals that actually died for the right to vote. Think about those individuals that lost their lives, that put their family in jeopardy, all because for you to have the right to vote. So just think about that and make that small sacrifice of your time.
Okay, you know what, Eric? We'll find out if your prediction comes true.
Yep, the numbers hold.
We will have you back very shortly so that we can talk about the results and where we go from here, the first 100 days, as you were talking about, and some other things. This is Eric Clavel with Hampton University and the Clavel Report. Thanks so much. I appreciate that. And it's been almost 3 years since WHRO embarked on its Veterans Coming Home initiative. Another View brought you stories addressing some of the many challenges that veterans face as they transition into civilian life. We looked at issues such as homelessness, unemployment, and involuntary separation. And we told you how programs like Adaptive Sports can give veterans a new start. Today, we venture down a different path as we explore how some veterans are using comedy to share their personal stories, bond with other veterans, and even heal. Our Lisa Godley recently sat down with Fred McKinnon and William Breckenridge, just two of the veterans featured in the upcoming WHRO TV 15 documentary, Comedy Boot Camp.
William Breckenridge was always the jokester. As a child, it was William who Dad called out to entertain company.
I always had a talent for making people laugh. My father had friends over, and he used to tell me to come out in the living room and walk like Fred Sanford, and I'd go out there and just say, shut up, dummy.
He carried his keen sense of comedic timing and gift for making people laugh through high school and on into the military. So when a friend suggested he take part in an 8-week comedy boot camp for veterans, William decided to give it a shot.
When I came into comedy boot camp, it was something real different for me because you can just tell jokes like around your friends and family and stuff, but it's not the same. The comedy boot camp is structured, and so we help each other out with taglines and jokes or whatever. And you have different people hearing your joke in a different way. And that's what's going to make you versatile, because everywhere you do a stand-up, it's going to be different people, you know.
I asked William to share the first joke he wrote in comedy boot camp.
All my jokes is about me, so I like to make fun of myself. And so my condition is PTSD. So the joke goes like something like this. You know, I got diagnosed with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. The strange thing about it, I thought I had that the whole time since I was like this high, like a little kid. But I just thought it meant something else. My mom used to take me to the store, and you know, being a little kid, you know, grabbing random stuff off the shelf, and she would hit me in the head and say, put that stuff down. And so that's what I thought PTSD meant, put that stuff down.
William was one of several veterans featured in the WHRO documentary Comedy Boot Camp. He's also one of a handful of vets whose comedy took them all the way to the White House. Joining William at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue was comedy boot camp instructor Fred McKinnon. Fred, a former Army officer, says he learned comedy from the School of Hard Knocks and wishes he'd had a place like comedy boot camp to hone his craft when he first started out.
I'm just one of those guys around the house to cook out. Something happens, I can say something and people usually laugh. But I never could see myself on stage.
Then one day, that changed.
One of my coworkers, who's a lieutenant colonel, said, hey, man, you missed your calling. You should be on stage. So I went to an open mic here in Newport News on Valentine's Day about 3 years ago. And I just sat in the crowd and watched people. And I watched people, it's a term called bombing, which is not doing well. And I said, man, I can get on there and do that. Then the following week, I went out there and tried it out, and people laughed. And then with the support of local comedians, they kept pushing me to go to different places and compete. I did that, and I started winning. And I was like, wow, this is even crazier.
He was then aided by advice from a fellow comedian who told him that while the bit he was doing was funny, it certainly wasn't for everyone, and challenged him to take his routine from an R rating to PG-13.
He challenged me to do more non-raunchy material. And I started to work on material that could be said in any environment and not just box myself into what people would consider a raunchy, you know, individual.
I asked Fred to share a joke from his family-friendly set.
I go to the VA every year to get an annual checkup, being a disabled vet. I went down there this past year and had a caseworker. He was really energetic about helping veterans. You know, he pulled me to the office. He was very secretive. He was like, hey, Fred, I'm going to see what I can do to increase your disability rate. And I said, no, I'm not the type of guy that takes advantage of the system. He said, well, let me see what I can do. I said, well, go and do your job. You know, don't let me block my blessing. He looks in the computer. He says, it says here you're a former signal officer. I said, yeah. He said, thanks for your service. He keeps looking. He says, uh-oh. I said, what? He said, it says here you was in the 82nd Airborne Division. I said, who? He said, you mean to tell me you was one of the guys who used to jump out the planes while it was flying? I said, yeah, man, but I had a parachute on. He said, no, you understand. For the purpose of this assessment, I need to annotate that had to be a very, very traumatic experience. I ain't catch it at first. I said, traumatic, man? No, actually, it was fun as I don't know. I said, I ain't been able to sleep ever since I jumped out of that gun.
I asked Fred and William where they'd like their comedy to take them. William says he's more than ready to follow in the footsteps of comedians who've taken their shows to the small and big screen. And he's thankful for all of the benefits that have come from being a part of the Comedy Bootcamp experience.
This program is very helpful for veterans such as myself and Fred. I was at a real down slope in my life, and just through my experience, it is very therapeutic for my PTSD, because when I'm doing stand-up, it's like I'm not that guy anymore, you know? I'm somebody else. I wish I could stay up there forever.
Seeing people in the audience, especially with the military shows and dealing with the veterans with, you know, PTSD or maybe going through, you know, Gold Star family members, just to see them laugh for 5 or 10 minutes makes me feel like I've given back.
For Another View, I'm Lisa Godley.
And you can hear more of Fred and William's stories in Comedy Bootcamp, the documentary, which will air on WHRO-TV Monday, November the 14th at 9 p.m. Visit comedybootcampdoc.org to find out more information. I cannot stress how critically important it is for all of us to exercise our right to vote. Even if you don't want to vote for presidential candidates, please vote for down ballot candidates, because that's what affects your life on a daily basis. Please do whatever you need to do to get to the polls. The Norfolk chapter of the NAACP is once again offering rides to the polls. It's called Souls to the Polls. To schedule a ride, call 757-749-3389. There's more information on our website, anotherviewradio.org. And if you need a happy release the day after the election, how about attending a group discussion on seasonal and local eating with Amy and Michael Drury of Drury Farms? You will learn some of the food traditions of southeastern Virginia and find out why our region is so unique. It's at the American Theater in Hampton from 6 until 8:30 on November the 9th. And the Portsmouth chapter of Jack and Jill of America Incorporated invites all Hampton Roads students, grades 1 through 12, to participate in the Hour of Code event. This event will introduce valuable computational thinking skills and computer science. It's absolutely free, but seating is limited. Go to jjportsmouth.org/community involvement for more information. Next week on Another View, the Another View Roundtable looks at the future based on Tuesday's election results. Our theme music was composed and performed by Jay Sennett. Lisa Godley is our show producer. Victor Bowen is our audio engineer. Monique Tosin and Nicholas Thomas answered our phones. November 8th is right around the corner. Go vote. I'm Barbara Ham Lee. We'll see you next Friday at noon for Another View.